me, your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Call our second case for this morning, 04-0723, In Re the Termination of Parental Rights to Shezron M. State v. James P. Before we start, we are expecting approximately 50 students from Hamilton High School, but they have not arrived, and they may not arrive. But if they do, 50 people walking in is a slight disturbance, so I don't want the people arguing the case to be disturbed by that. They will just proceed. Representing James P. is Carl W. Chesser, is that correct? Who has 25 minutes to argue. We will then hear 20 minutes of argument by Thomas C. Binger, Assistant District Attorney in Milwaukee, representing the state of Wisconsin, and then 10 minutes by Sheila R. Hill Roberts, who is the guardian ad litem, and then 5 minutes rebuttal by Mr. Chesser. Mr. Chesser, you may proceed.
Thank you very much. Please, the court, I would also like to introduce Attorney Scott Sussman. He's seated at the table with me, and he was the author of the amicus brief that was filed on behalf of the Center for Family Policy and Practice. Good morning, Justices. I'm Attorney Carl Chesser, and I represent the petitioner James P. The issue in this case revolves around the definition of parent in the statute that Wisconsin 48.02 subsection 13, and whether or not that definition applies to my client James P. for the purposes of terminating his parental rights pursuant to Wisconsin statute 48.415-1A3, which is the abandonment provision of the ground statute for the termination of parental rights. Now, one thing I find interesting is both the Court of Appeals and I, we all agree that the statute is not ambiguous, and we believe that the plain meaning of the language can discern the meaning of what is meant by parent in that statute. In the Court of Appeals decision, Judge Fine characterized my legal argument as law school question type analyses. What I was attempting to do was apply the canons of statutory interpretation, and that's what I'd like to try and do today. What I would do is I would look at the first sentence of statute 48.0213, and it states that a parent means a biological parent, a parent where a husband consents to the artificial insemination of his wife, or adoption. And then there's a period. There's no conjunctive to the second sentence. I look at the statutory rule of egestem generis and noceter e suesis, which basically tell us that when you have a general term it's followed by specific terms, that application of that general term is then restricted by the specific words that follow it. In this statute, you have a general term of biological parent. Now, arguably, that would cover any and all parent. But because it's followed by restricted, more specific phrases, then that application is restricted. And essentially, what that first sentence does is it says that there are three methods in which a married couple can be legally recognized as parents. One is they can biologically procreate. The second is they can have artificial insemination. And the third is that they can adopt. But then we move on to the second sentence. And the second sentence starts off with the phrase, if the child is a non-marital child. Now, in this case, Shezron M. is a non-marital child. And then it goes on to identify basically five methods in which a parent, a father like James P., can be determined or found to be the legal parent of Shezron M. And those methods are, first of all, he could have married Shezron's mother. He could have adopted Chevron. He could have filed an acknowledgement in this state or another state, or he could have gotten himself legally adjudicated as her biological father. And I find it interesting that we talk about adjudication, because that's a legal proceeding in which rights are recognized. And I think it merits a couple of moments here to think about that. It's not a scientific process.
Counselor, well, can I interrupt you just a minute?
Sure.
Let's just say I agree with you, and the statute is broken into two parts, and the first part talks about how you are a parent if it's a married couple, and the second part talks about parents for non-marital child. Does that really answer our question here? Because can't one be determined to be a parent or a child in a later judicial proceeding but have rights that date back to what your status always was? And let me give you an example. Let's say a man has a child out of wedlock and he dies and the child tries to assert rights against his estate. If he has the ability to prove that he is the child of that man, then his rights date back to what they always were. He always was the child. So I'm not sure breaking the statute into two parts really answers the question that most troubles me in this case.
Well, you raise an interesting situation. I guess I could also throw out a couple of other facets that could be thrown in there. Let's assume that that child was a product of a marriage and the father was not a part of that marriage. Would that child still be able to assert legal rights?
Well, you'd have to have a proceeding because the child is presumed to be the child of the husband until shown otherwise, but it's a rebuttable presumption. So you could probably still get there if the child was, in fact, a child of a paramour or the mother or the wife.
But what I think is of more paramount importance is that what we're discussing here is termination of parental rights. You know, we're not looking to find, we're not talking about, okay, we want to give him parental rights. We're looking to terminate him. And I think that's a big distinction.
Well, I guess I understood your brief to be that you can't terminate his parental rights based on abandonment because he didn't have any obligation to be there at the time that abandonment was shown, right? Isn't that what you're saying? I mean, you're saying he wasn't a parent at the time when he agrees he didn't contact the child. So the timing is somewhat of an issue in this case.
That's correct, but I think it's, yes, it is an issue, but I think it's very important that James P. did step up and become adjudicated. And what happens there?
He stepped up before he became adjudicated. I thought he stepped up when he became a parent. In other words, as I was looking at the record, he acted like a parent. He gave the child his name. He used his insurance to insure the child. He lived with the child. The child called him dad. Isn't that where he first stepped up?
Actually, yes, that's true. But at that point in time, he was not legally recognized as that child's parent.
Why not?
Well, because he was not married to the mother.
So that's the point. It's the marriage point.
That's correct.
Well, there are other ways you can get the child recognized. There's acknowledgement under 767.621, right? Is that done here?
No.
No. He was adjudicated.
All right.
Did he know at the time, do the facts indicate that he knew at the time that he put the child on the insurance and other things referenced by Justice Wilcox? Do the facts indicate that he was sure that he was the biological father?
From my understanding, I was not at the trial court level, but my understanding is that there was some doubt that apparently the mother had indicated that there could have been another father. But I think, going back to Justice Wilcox's question here, we're talking about behavior and conduct. And again, I think if you look at the definition for parent, under 48.0213, that doesn't exist there. And so conduct does not give a person, or James P., the legal recognition as being a parent.
But I'm not sure your argument as to the definition of parent exists either. I mean, as I understand your argument, you're separating out sentence one and saying it applies to married people, and sentence two applies to unmarried people.
Correct.
But the only thing that suggests anything at all with respect to married people in sentence one is where a husband has consented to the artificial insemination of the wife. I don't see anything relating to marriage with respect to biological parent. I don't see anything relating to marriage with respect to parent by adoption. And I think you would concede you can have different people adopting that has nothing to do with marriage, right?
That's correct.
And I know you make an argument that you can get to adoptions with unmarried people in sentence two, but I'm looking at sentence two and it doesn't quite say that. It says if the child is a non-marital child who is not adopted. It doesn't provide for adoption. It says if you're not there, then we go somewhere else, correct?
Right, if he's not adoption. That pulls the
child
out
of the parent. Can't that refer back to sentence one?
I guess that's my concern, is why would we have adoption in both sentences? Why would there be a period after that adoption? Why wouldn't it just be one sentence? Why wouldn't there be a conjunctive there to include all these if they're all supposed to be strung together? But what I think is more important is where the Court of Appeals is saying that once he's adjudicated as the biological father, that somehow that goes back to being a biological parent. And I think if you read the statute, in the second sentence, you also have the phrase parent includes, and then it goes on to those other three. So
let's talk about that includes. Under State versus Caldwell, and I believe Michigan Gas Light Company versus Department of Taxation, haven't we previously said that the term includes is usually a term of enlargement, not limitation?
And actually, as my colleague, however, cited in his amicus brief, there's also case law saying that it's not necessarily always means that. However, I think even if you use that, what they're doing is they're talking about the expanding parent. They're not talking about expanding biological parent. It doesn't say biological parent includes. And there's one of the problems I have with the Court of Appeals reasoning, is they kind of make this quantum leap from an adjudication of being a biological father all the way back to a biological parent. And I don't see where the statute says that at all.
This biological father is a different entity than a biological parent? Isn't parent just a sex-neutral term?
Actually, I guess my feeling is that no.
No.
And the reason I say that is because biological father, I believe, is actually a conclusion of law. That's created through an adjudication process. That's why I think that's significant. Yes, we do have DNA testing or blood testing, but it's also possible for someone to be determined a biological father adjudicated by default. And so...
We now have had the evolution of DNA evidence, correct?
Pardon?
We now have the evolution of DNA evidence.
Yes.
Where, at least scientifically, in theory, you can determine who a biological parent is absent an adjudication, correct?
Correct.
So why doesn't the statute include that?
Well, because the statute doesn't say that. The statute doesn't say it's dependent upon DNA testing.
Oh, it says biological parent. We now know that we have a way to determine that.
Well, that's a scientific way, but that's not necessarily a legal way. As I said, that's why you can find a biological parent, technically speaking, in an adjudication process without any DNA testing.
How do you do that?
Well, there can be a paternity suit that frequently is started because they want...
Doesn't that usually rely on some blood test?
Actually, you can have situations in which the father doesn't respond, doesn't come to the hearings, doesn't give a blood test, and the court will go ahead and proceed and find them in default.
Okay. But it's an adjudication.
That's correct.
In fact, that happens with some frequent, used to, when I was doing paternity as a circuit court judge, that happened with some frequency on paternity morning, Tuesday mornings, as we would go through the file, that a large percentage or significant percentage would be by default, and we just had to make sure that they had all of the necessary process and that the service had been completed and the affidavits of service had been on file before then we would proceed to adjudicate them to as being the father of the child.
Actually, and if there is an adjudication and it comes back later that the DNA testing shows that the father is not the biological father, that doesn't necessarily mean a reversal there. And unfortunately, I remember researching it because I was looking for a different issue, a different case, but there was a case where a woman came into court and testified that this was the father, and it was adjudicated. Later on, they found out the DNA testing proved that he wasn't, but he was not able to come in and overturn that. So it's not always necessarily conclusive.
You are, I should say, that Judge Fine's appellate decision says, look, during the abandonment period, there was a DNA testing. And under the second sentence, the child was a non-marital child. And he wasn't adopted. The child wasn't adopted. The parents didn't marry. No acknowledgement. But there was an adjudication to be a biological father. And once that person is adjudicated to be a biological father, that person was a biological father from the time of conception, let alone birth. Right?
Arguably, it could have been, yes.
Well, let's forget the law for a moment. Common okay. sense. The person, the father. I mean, if at 35... there's a biological test and some, I'll make it worse, at 71 there's a biological test and it is now determined that Mr. Z is my father, biologically. Right?
Yes.
He was my father from the very beginning. Maybe I didn't know, maybe he didn't know, but that's where it is, right?
Right, from a biological standpoint, that's
right.
Absolutely correct.
And so Fine says, from a biological standpoint, you go back and read the statute, and he falls under the first sentence, because he's a biological parent, or he falls under the second sentence, that he was adjudicated a biological father. And under any reading, says Judge Fine, you are wrong. Right?
Yes.
It is your position, if I understand it, that where you rely on an adjudication of paternity, especially in non-marital, where you don't have a presumption, that true from a biological standpoint, the man's the father from the beginning, as a legal matter, he should be the father only from the time that he really learns he is the father. And you shouldn't bind his legal rights to times when he doesn't know, right?
That's correct.
That's your position.
Well, when he's not legally recognized as the father.
Okay. Now, suppose that in year three of the child, he is adjudicated the father. Does he have to pay back support?
No.
He only starts from the time of adjudication.
And again, I believe the amicus brief addressed that.
And you're saying it's unfair, just like in child support, it's unfair to sock him when he didn't know what was happening to him. Therefore, it's unfair to do the abandonment because he didn't know he was the father.
Well, actually, I would take it a step further. I think when he became adjudicated, there's some things that happen. And first of all, he then has standing to contest the termination of his rights. But then he also would be subject to a CHIPS order in which he's going to have to meet conditions in order to have the child returned to him. And then he's also going to be financially responsible.
Mm-hmm.
So I think like when someone steps up and becomes adjudicated, they also put on this cloak of responsibility. And so I think it actually is even a little bit more than what you were referring to.
Let me tell you what my hypothesis is about this case. My hypothesis is that under the facts here, he recognized, he acknowledged his paternity in the way he dealt with this child. Treated it as his child, cared for it as his child, supported it as his child, and that for purposes of 480213, where a father does that, where a male does that, that you can either say it's the biological parent because he's a stop to deny it for the moment, especially if he's later adjudicated under the first sentence, or that where he has undertaken the responsibilities of parenthood and then he's adjudicated, it relates back. So I would deal with a very narrow fact situation we have presented here. That's my hypothesis. But, of course, I have to follow the statute, so I've got to fit it under the statute, and I've tried to do that. And as other justices have pointed out, when you deal with non-marital child, the statute says include, so I can just add to that acknowledgement by the father. As another step. What's the matter with my hypothesis?
Okay. I guess, first of all, you're talking about him acknowledging how he acknowledged the Cheswa. But he also did not do that in a legal sense.
Well, people are held to their conduct, and you can make inferences from their conduct, right? I mean, there are a lot of married couples, as you know. They have children. Child might or might not be product of the marriage, right?
Yeah, and first of all, as I indicated before, conduct is not, the statute does not define conduct as a means to determine parenthood. But furthermore, I think that you run into a bigger difficulty in exactly what does someone have to manifest in conduct in order for them to become a parent?
Listen, courts are always able to take care of that. We can look at that. I mean, it's not an exact science, but we can look at it. I mean, he did everything that a biological father or an adopted father would do, right?
Yes.
Okay, so we've got that settled.
Well, that's my opinion. But I'm sure that you could find other people that we're not necessarily agree with that.
You can say he was told that it might not be his child. He decided that under the circumstances, he could love the child anyway and take care of it, right? People do that all the time, too.
That's correct.
Okay. So? Where does he get it? What's the matter with my hypothesis?
I guess, again, I believe it's the plain language of the statute that is controlling here.
Plain language says includes, doesn't seem limited to, but the first sentence says means, and you still have to define biological parent. Why can't you define it if you undertake it as a biological parent, it's yours as a biological parent under the statute?
Well, I guess my concern is that such an encompassing term?
Sure.
Is that if you follow that logic, I'm not sure why do you even need the second sentence? You particularly don't need if it's a marital child.
Legislature drafts banned statutes all the time.
But I guess I feel it's my job, though, to ask that the statute be applied as it is, unless we find that it's not ambiguous, unless we find it's ambiguous.
Suppose you find it ambiguous. What does the legislative history show?
Well, I think once again, I refer to the amicus brief, and what it shows is a progression, actually, of how the second sentence developed. I mean, we started off with children that were out of wedlock, and they initially were considered bastards. They were legal non-entities. They had no rights, and their parents had no rights. And then we progressed to where we wanted to give the mothers rights, particularly for persons of custody and adoption, and those rights attached to childbirth. But you still had the unwed father out there. And it wasn't until Stanley versus Illinois came in that we were obligated to start to recognize that perhaps unwed fathers had some legal rights. So I think
doesn't the progression of the statute show, though, that a recognition over time of anyone who is actually a parent of the child? Isn't that the progression? In other words, it's not limiting the definition of a parent. It's recognizing that there are other individuals out there that may be a parent.
I think that that's sentence number two. That's the second sentence. That's the purpose of it.
Because if you look at the evolution of sentence number one, from natural to biological, you look at the elimination of the term parent means mother. I mean, if you look at the history of the statute, it seems to be a recognition that society has to recognize everyone's rights out here with respect to these children.
I guess, yes, I'm saying that that's correct. I'm saying that that second sentence developed the rights for the unwed father, and that meant being adjudicated, and that's when you became legally recognized as the parent. And I don't see where that statute is saying that it reverts back to biological parent.
But here's the problem with your argument. Your argument all along says, give meaning to every word in the statute.
Yes.
As that first sentence has evolved from natural parent to biological parent, as I read it, it doesn't say biological mother. It says biological parent. For us to give meaning to every word, you're asking us to read parent to mean something other than parent.
I don't quite follow.
As I understand your argument, that first line, you're arguing biological parent does not include a biological unwed father. You're reading out part of what biological parent means. You're lopping it out of the first sentence.
That's right. And I think that's because you have the second sentence and you've got to give meaning to it.
All right.
Could I ask at the court trial, what was James P.'s defense other than perhaps this argument?
Actually, I wasn't at the trial court level, but my understanding is basically they stipulated to the periods of abandonment, and there was an agreement that it wasn't until 2002 that he became adjudicated.
Did he get all the notices for the termination, all the notices for CHIPS? Was he part of all that proceedings?
The part that I recall from the record is that at least there were a couple, three CHIPS hearings that he appeared at, and then I'm not sure that he reappeared again until he became adjudicated.
So he participated in these proceedings. But he's not claiming he didn't know that there was a proceeding that could lead to termination.
Well, I guess I can't lean that one way or the other, what his knowledge was.
But that's not your argument here, is that my argument could be that he was gone from the house by then, no one told him that the proceedings were on, and all of a sudden a year passes and he's clipped and he doesn't know anything about it. That's not his defense here.
I'm not sure if there wasn't a period of time where he wasn't given notices, but I don't know that.
I'll check. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chesser. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Binger, District Attorney Binger.
Thank you. May it please the Court. Good morning. My name is Tom Miller. I'm the Assistant District Attorney on this case representing the State. There are many undisputed facts in this case. There are many findings of fact that the trial court made here that are not being challenged on appeal. The most fundamental of those is that James P. was always the father of this child and always knew he was the father of this child. In answer to your question, Justice Abramson, at trial, James P. was attempting to raise a defense that he did not know this was his child. The mother testified at trial She indicated that she believed it was his, that it could have been someone else's, but they were living together at the time of the birth. They raised the child for the first 18 months together after that until the mother developed a drug problem, and he kicked both the mother out as well as the two children. And about a year, year and a half later, in early 1998, the Child Protective Services got involved. Now, at that time, James P. knew that Child Protective Services was going to be involved in the family, and in fact, he knew that they were seeking to detain this child, Sharon M.
Was he given notice?
He was notified of the initial CHIPS hearings and did appear at one of the initial CHIPS hearings in 1998.
Why was he given notice?
Because he was named as the alleged father by the mother. In fact, the child was being hid by him, along with the mother, from Child Protective Services. He knew that they were trying to detain the child. He assisted the mother in hiding the child. And then in 1998, as part of the CHIPS proceedings, he did appear in court. He was designated by the court as the, on the docket record as the alleged father. Subsequent notices were sent to him by the child social workers on the case, attempting to get into contact with him, get him involved in the case. In 2001, he finally did reappear in court at a permanency plan hearing, and at that time made contact with that current social worker at that time, and that's what led to the adjudication process. At the time of the TPR, he was adjudicated. When the TPR petition was filed, he had been adjudicated. He received notices of that and participated in the entire TPR process. Despite his denials of knowledge of this child, the court made a finding of fact that he knew that this was his child. And I think the record amply supported that finding. And that's not being challenged here on appeal.
When did he know?
During the mother's pregnancy, she testified that she informed him.
What was the finding of fact? Did it say when he knew?
It didn't get specific as to the time, but it as part of the testimony at trial, the mother testified that she told him during the pregnancy that this was his child, that it could be someone else's child as well. He was present at the birth of the child in the hospital. He held himself out as the father of the child, including having the child put on his health insurance. He also attempted to get a life insurance policy in the child's name, and in fact he misled his health insurance company about the real name of the child, giving the child his last name and telling the health insurance company that he was married to the mother, which was not in fact true. This is someone who all along has known he's the father of this child, held himself out as the father of the child, but ironically now he is seeking to hide behind the very procedures in the statutes that historically have been designed to give him rights. Historically, these procedures have been put in place to recognize people in his circumstance, fathers of non-marital children, and give them the ability to get in the courthouse, the ability to participate in these cases. He deliberately dropped the ball, deliberately did not take advantage of those procedures for the first 7 years of this child's life. And now he wants to claim that because he didn't do so, during those first 7 years, this child had no father.
Counsel, do you do paternity proceedings? Is that what you do?
No, I do not.
Do you know the answer to my question of how many paternity proceedings are adjudicated by default in Milwaukee County?
I don't have the figures on that, but I'm also aware, as you are, that that is not an uncommon procedure. And I think that reflects the law's presumption that every child has two parents, and that we are going to seek to find fathers of children and have them responsible for those children. We would rather go forward with finding at least one father, and sometimes even more than one father in the case of an adoption, or perhaps when there's a marital child that is really the product of an extramarital affair. We will go forward and find more fathers rather than step backwards, which is what the defender or what the father here is arguing, and go back to zero.
You know, and I'm not only for motherhood, I'm for fatherhood, you know. But my concern is this. At the outset, it seems so simple. If you adjudicate the father, that automatically means you've always been the biological father. From, you know, ab initio. And I say, that's wrong. It seems simple, but it's wrong. It's wrong because, now let me pull a statistic, and this may not be accurate, but let's say 20 to 25% of paternities
at least in Marathon County, went by way of default. That means there was no testing, there's no blood test, there's no DNA, there's nothing. You made sure that if they located finally this young man who's 20, who's living in Trenton, New Jersey, and going to technical school there, and he sends back that you've gotten all the process was served, and it's entered by default. Now, I'm not sure my statistic is right. It's been so long. But I just know that it happened with frequency. I don't know how frequent. But let's say 20 to 25% went by way of default. So we have all those adjudicated fathers. But it very well could be that some of them, maybe even many of them, are not actually the biological father. And never were the biological father of Ignatia. But we deal with that because it's a default, and so we adjudicate them the father. It doesn't mean they are a biological parent. But we have this legal phrase, this legal entity, a biological father, through the adjudication process, who most likely is, but we're not sure, adjudicated father, who most likely is, but we're not sure, is the biological father, right?
And in 4802.13, that term of inclusion reaches those fathers and would allow us to encompass them under the definition of a parent under 4802.13. We would then be able to go forward and terminate their parental rights. And maybe they aren't the father, in which case we're terminating the rights of someone who isn't really the father of the child. Mm-hmm. This case is an abandonment case under 48.415(1)(a)(3), and there are good cause defenses to that. James P. could have argued, and I think he was implicitly arguing, that he had good cause to fail to visit with the child during the six-month periods, fail to communicate with the child, that he may have raised that he had communications with the people who had custody of the child, or that he had good cause for failing to have those communications. So built into this abandonment grounds here is a defense that protects the unknowing father, the person who might have been misled about the child, might have not have known that the child existed.
Mr. Banger, if I could follow up on Justice Bradley's question, maybe I took the question differently than you do, but I think the concern is that because of that default judgment, you may have an adjudication of a person as the biological father who indeed is not the biological father.
Yes. Chapter 67 allows that result right now.
I understand it, but I guess the point is, under the theory advanced by Judge Fine in the opinion, that theory of the adjudication relates back so that now that person always was the biological father, even though he may not have been.
Certainly. And under Chapter 767, there is a specific limitation on going back and getting child support. It's limited to the date of the filing of the petition for paternity. So that person would be on the hook from the date of that filing on. And that's what 767 allows. The legislature's made a decision there, a policy decision, that we are going to, rather than have zero fathers, we will try and notify someone and perhaps even adjudicate someone by default. Now, out at in Milwaukee County, what we can do under these procedures now, for example, if James P. had come into court nowadays, we have a procedure where we can take a DNA sample of a father when they come to court in a very quick procedure and then compare that to the DNA of the child. So we have a much quicker way and a much better system of handling that when someone like this comes in as the alleged father here. But James P. is the biological father. We know that through the paternity testing. We have the DNA testing which shows that.
Where does he fall under the statute? What exactly under the statute do you rely on that he is a parent and that you can terminate him and that it's he's gotten all of 48.415(1)(a)(3) rights?
The first clause of 48.02(13), which defines parent as a biological parent.
And when is he a biological parent? The minute that child was conceived or when he was adjudicated?
The minute that child was conceived.
How do we know that?
That's the problem that the historically and the Center for Family Policy and Practice has laid out the evolution of this statute. What we have nowadays, as Justice Butler has pointed out, is we have a conclusive method of determining that. And I think historically the reason that there's been a distinction in the statutes is that in the past we didn't have that scientific certainty, virtual certainty that we have nowadays through DNA testing. Ultimately, though, it is James P.'s burden to come forward and assume that responsibility. And so,
you know what's bothering me? What's bothering me, correct me if I'm wrong, but in this termination of parental rights, of course, it isn't just the county, but it's others that can bring a petition to terminate rights. My experience tells me that when it comes to paternity and that there are as many variations of stories and truth and fantastical events that you couldn't believe exist but do. Mm-hmm. And so you could have a person adjudicated the father 8 years, 10 years after conception. DNA testing, let's say he wants to establish fatherhood. He thinks that all of a sudden, 10 years later, after birth, he might be the father of that child that the mother has kept from him and knowing him. So he hears it from a cousin's through their neighbors, uncles, aunts, you know, I mean, this kind of stuff. So he decides that he wants to have testing done. He's adjudicated as the father. Indeed, the testing shows he is the father. The mother then files a petition for abandonment.
And he's got a good cause defense.
Yeah, but see, he has to be brought into court. He has to have an initial hearing. You have to have a pretrial. He's got to hire an attorney. You got to have a jury trial, you know, if you want one. And then he says, oh, Your Honor, though, let me put forth on the second day of trial my good cause defense.
Yes, absolutely. And the adjudication procedure is the way that we determine whether or not the system is going to expend resources on him. He gets those rights because of the adjudication procedure, but he always was the father of that child. And compare that to a circumstance in which someone, rather than waiting 8 or 10 years, had become adjudicated right away at the beginning of the child's life. They sent in a declaration of paternal interest, for example. Or in other states, there are putative father registries, which require registering or sending in a card shortly after the child's birth. For a father to do that right away at birth opens them up to all of these TPR grounds, all of these potential grounds from then on. James P. is trying to avoid all of those by sitting on his rights. Yeah. If the defense's argument is believed here, it's a disincentive for people to come forward and claim paternity. They open themselves up.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Mayor. Could the state accept a construction of the statute that would distinguish the, quote, biological parent in sentence one from the adjudicated parent in sentence two, whereas the biological parent really was the parent all along, but if you're an adjudicated parent, you only go back to the date of adjudication?
You're asking, could the state accept that?
Yes. Is that acceptable to your position? I don't know if that is your position, but is that acceptable to the state?
No, it is not, because I think that we need to make a policy incentive that these people, like James P., who are the fathers of non-marital children, come forward and assert their rights as early as possible.
Then don't you have the problem that Justice Bradley alluded to with the default judgment situation?
That is a concern, and that may be something the legislature can address in 767, but I think it reflects a presumption that we are going to find fathers for children rather than adopt the position of James P. that this child had no father for the first 7 years.
But you're not trying to find a father here. You're trying to get rid of one.
Well, but he needs to find himself, essentially. We have to, the ultimate goal in this case is to get this child adopted. Right. And the court has found that it's in the best interest of this child to have the child be adopted by the people who are raising the child. The child is placed in a home with the sibling, the older daughter, who is the child of the mother but not of this father. And that adoption is awaiting here. In order for us to go forward, the only ground for termination of parental rights here is this ground. At trial, I filed a petition alleging a failure to assume ground under 48415 sub 6, and after James P.'s testimony, I dismissed that for some of the reasons that Justice Abramson alluded to. He had held himself out as the father. He had taken that step. And the Supreme Court cases like Lair v. Robertson, for example, talk about a parent being more than just a biological relationship, being someone who assumes a responsibility for the child. Here he had done that. So when it was convenient for him, he could hold himself out as the parent. But now, when he's facing termination, he wants to hide behind these statutes.
Now, we have a problem here of statutory interpretation, right? I mean, that's
the fundamental issue, yes.
Right. And abandonment talks about the parent leaving the child. So that gets you into 480213 as to what is a parent. But in this case, you've got a man who acknowledges, does various conduct, that this is the child. Might be his child, might not be his child biologically, but he acts like it is. He is alleged to be the parent in your proceedings. He then appears at these proceedings. He's given an opportunity to make his pitch, right? He doesn't make his pitch. Proceedings proceed sometimes with him, sometimes without him. But has he gotten all the right notices? If he were the father from the very beginning and adjudicated, do you get all the right notices here?
After the adjudication, he was notified of the TPR and fully participated in that. As part of the CHIPS proceeding, there were attempts to notify him during that proceeding. They weren't always successful. They were sent to his last known address.
He were the father. There was a married couple, and he was the father. Did he get all the right notices all the time, whether he showed up or not?
If this were a case where he was a married father?
Yeah.
And the presumption applied?
Yeah.
Well, our practice would be to give him those notices.
No, but did you give it to him here? I'm trying to see whether he got full protection in this proceeding.
As part of the CHIPS proceeding here, every year that the CHIPS order was being reviewed by the court, 98, 99, 2000, 2001, there were attempts to notify him. He had a consistent address throughout. He actually appeared in 1998. In the record, there's a letter from the social worker, which I believe was in 99, notifying him that there was Child Protective Services involved in the case. He also received notice of a permanency plan here in 2001 because he came to that. The procedure is always to give them the notice, whether or not it's successful in reaching them, whether or not they actually respond to it or not.
That would be true if it were a marital child, too.
Right. And if it's a marital child, there's a presumption that applies. And that presumption says that if the child is born to a married couple, then that the father is the natural father. It doesn't say that the presumption is that that person's a parent. It just says that the father is a natural father, which gets us back to 480213. If that person is a natural father, then they've got to fall under that first part of the sentence, and they're a biological father. So that person only becomes a parent by virtue of 480213, just like here in this case where James P. was the biological father all along of this child. The distinction that they're making in the first sentence applying to marital children and the second sentence applying to non-marital children leaves out the mothers of non-marital children. The first sentence only applies to marital children, so those mothers aren't defined there. In the second sentence, we're only dealing with fathers of non-marital children. So how does the mother of this child fall under the definition of parent, if that interpretation is correct? And that's why this interpretation leads to absurd results. I think fundamentally we're trying to broaden the circle of people who may be parents in the hopes that we're going to find somebody here like James P. And it's his control here. It's always been his control over asserting that parenthood, of coming forth and taking that responsibility.
Do you ever know of a case in Wisconsin where there is a question as to did the mother give birth to that child? I mean, it seems to me knowing who the mother is a pretty easy thing. Now, you might have some case where a child was kidnapped and, you know, in the hospital, babies were changed or something like that. But absent that kind of kidnapping situation, I mean, I don't think there's much to discover as to where the baby came from and who the baby came from, is there?
Absolutely. And we always assume the mother is the biological parent.
It need not be. Could that be an artificial insemination with somebody else's egg? Doesn't have to be a biological parent.
Could be.
Giving birth to that child is not the equivalent of being a biological mother.
True, but the father's interpretation here treats fathers differently than mothers because it's almost an equal protection violation. A mother is always on the hook as the biological parent from the beginning. What his argument is that he is not on the hook until he comes forward and asserts his paternity and becomes adjudicated. And so he's arguing that he should be treated differently than the biological mothers. But 480213 says biological parent. He falls in that same class.
Thank you, Mr. Binger.
Thank you.
We'll now hear from the guardian ad litem, Attorney Sheila R. Hill Roberts.
May it please the Court. I am Sheila Hill Roberts, the guardian ad litem for the child, Shezron M. Also sitting at council table is Chief Staff Attorney from Legal Aid, Mr. Mike Bruno. Just to answer the question with respect to whether or not the father received requisite notice, Section 48273B requires notifying alleged fathers in all CHIPS cases. What this case is about is James P., the biological father, abandoning his daughter, Shezron, and then trying to say that the abandonment statute does not apply. James wants us to believe that he did not know that this was his child or that he was not the father until he became adjudicated in 2002. James's story is not credible. James has always held himself out as being the biological father. The facts are uncontested. James acknowledged and assumed the role as biological father during the early years of Shezron's life. We know that James was having a communal relations with the mother during the conceptive period, that James went to the hospital to visit his daughter, that James covered his daughter on his health insurance and also took out a life insurance, that James lived with the mother before, during, and after Shezron's birth. James treated Shezron in all respects as his biological daughter. And by his own testimony, James indicated that Shezron called him dad. But when Shezron entered into the foster care system at 3, James dropped out of her life. He abandoned her, not for 6 months, but a significant period of time. James made little or no attempt to maintain contact with Shezron. James had the opportunity to do so, but failed to do so. As it was indicated earlier, James received notices. He attended a few hearings early on in Shezron's CHIPS proceedings. James received a notice from the social worker inviting him to come and meet with her so he could discuss issues regarding his daughter. She even indicated to him that should he not, decisions could be made regarding terminating his parental rights. Armed with all of that information, James made no inquiries regarding...
Counselor, you say that the child was taken out of the parental home at 3 and now she's going to be 10 soon in April, right?
That's correct.
Is there anything in the record that would tell us how long she's been with the people that she currently lives with?
Yes, there is something in the record. She has been with the current caretaker since June of 2002.
Okay, thank you. Counsel,
we're not talking about equitable parenthood here. We're talking about biological parenthood. What role does conduct play in a other than the conduct of having intercourse, of course, what role does conduct play in establishing biological parenthood, if any? Because your argument, you know, is compelling. I mean, I want to listen to you and I want to say, I don't know, this James guy, I mean, out of here, you know, I don't want anything to do with this guy. But I've got to be careful because, of course, the law that we devour,
the law that we apply here applies to everyone in all sorts of fact situations. So your argument thus far has been based on misconduct. Puts the kid in his insurance policy, you know, the kid were old enough, you take the kid to school, you know, feed the kid, change the diapers. What's the answer to that question? What role does conduct have in establishing biological parenthood, if any?
Well, in the sense that James has always held himself out, and once there was a determination genetically that he was a father, he's held responsible for holding himself out as that child's father since the child was born.
If there was an adjudication that he was the father based on DNA, do you need any conduct?
No.
Okay. So to your legal analysis, because you have an adjudication here through science, based on your legal analysis, I think conduct plays no role. It causes me to be sympathetic, but it plays no legal analysis. That conduct, absent establishment by scientific proof, has no role in establishing biological parenthood. Am I right or wrong?
That is correct, Your Honor. Once he became adjudicated, he is determined at that point to be the biological father under the definition of 4802 sub 13. And that is plain and that is clear. He is the biological father. And conduct with respect to that needs not to be elaborated on.
Why don't you argue that it's irrelevant whether he's a parent? Why don't you argue it's irrelevant whether he's a parent? She alleges he's a parent. He gets all the notices under the statute as if he's a parent. He gets the right in these fact situations to appear, fight it out, make his arguments, and he does sometimes appear. And that in light of that, all of his procedural due processes, if he were a parent, have been covered. So it's irrelevant whether he's a parent or not. His rights are finished because he got all the rights of a parent. If he was an interloper, he was heard. If he's a parent, he was heard. Go home.
Well, it's inapplicable whether or not a non-adjudicated father has been determined to be the biological father. His rights do not act retroactively. So he's determined to be the father.
Well, suppose he wasn't here. Forget the DNA. And you have the exact same fact situation. What would you argue?
If we just deal away with the DNA?
Mm-hmm. And he comes in now and says, hey, I'm Daddy-O, and you can't terminate me because at that time I wasn't the father because there's no adjudication. So now I'm acknowledging it and I'll sign all the sheets of paper, but it doesn't relate back. You don't have the DNA. Only you have my conduct.
Until he steps up to acknowledge that he is the father, we cannot terminate his rights. We can only terminate a parent's right under the statute.
If the mother lies and says the father is dead, right?
Right.
Or she doesn't know the father, or she gives you four names and not his, what happens?
I think the statute clearly covers those kind of situations, the abandonment statute. If she has lied and there's been some deception there, the statute provides two things. One, the state must prove the element that the father had some knowledge about the child's existence or whereabouts. So I think he can defeat it just on that ground. But even then, if he doesn't do it there's the good cause clause that he could also use.
The statute will now allow the state to defeat his rights.
Right.
Why can't you use those statutes here? His rights are defeated. You'd have to stretch it a little. His rights are defeated because he got all the notices, et cetera. Therefore, he can't come in and complain now.
That is what we're arguing. He should not be able to complain now because he was given all of the procedural rights and protection. And he failed to provide the court with a good cause explanation why he failed to have any contact. What I like to say is that this statute is, this case is based on an abandonment, failing to have contact, as opposed to an adjudication. And also the whole purpose of the abandonment statute is not designed to determine who the biological father is or to punish or protect an alleged father, but rather is to protect Chevron from the emotional harm occasioned from a parent like James disappearing or having extended absences from that child's life. And I think that is the purpose of the abandonment statute. And I think clearly, based on the record, James P. abandoned this child.
If it's his child, which the issue is, when was it his child?
I think it was his child from the date of conception and not from the onset of the adjudication.
Any questions of Attorney Hill Roberts? Justice Glasser.
I'm listening to this, and it seems to me that several members of the court are uncomfortable with the concept that the parent, that someone is a parent solely because of a scientific determination at some point. Do you perceive some dangers of the court saying that?
Well, yes, but the definition of parent is, biological parent is inclusive. I mean, the first sentence of the sentence includes biological parent, but the legislature intended to supplement that definition with other scenarios. And parent can be defined by other ways. We recognize that all parents do not have a biological tie with the child. Therefore, the definition needs to be supplemented to include those other examples.
Do you see any circumstances in which a determination that someone is a biological parent solely by a scientific test at some point would actually work to hurt the interests of the child?
Well, to hurt the interests of the child, no. If he's determined to be the biological father and he's held himself out in that capacity, that can only serve to benefit the child.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Mr. Jesser.
I would like to respond to some of the comments that were made. First of all, I'd like to look back at Chapter 48 and what's behind that. And I look at Statute 48.1 entitled Title and Legislative Purpose. And some of the things that are noted in there is that it's to preserve the unity of family by strengthening family life through assisting parents and in fulfilling their responsibility as parents. We've ended up delving into the facts quite a bit in this case, and there's a couple things that I find a little disturbing. We have a parent, James P., who steps up in the year 2002, says, okay, I'm adjudicated, I'm going to accept all the responsibilities of parenthood, and what happens? His rights are terminated in the year 2002. And I submit that we would want to make a distinction between a parent who steps up and assumes responsibility and then turns around and abandons a child. Because then we know that that he has done that and what we want to do. I also think that if, you, again, you follow the Court of Appeals reasoning and the state's reasoning, what you're going to have is a chilling effect on unwed and alleged fathers stepping forth. Why would somebody want to step forth and become adjudicated when they're going to find out that they're going to turn around and find out that whatever they did before they became adjudicated is going to terminate their parental rights anyhow? So I think, again, the other thing is that we've been struggling quite a bit with...
Isn't part of the problem, though, with the fact that he's stepping forward under your rationale when the child is seven? What happened to the first 6 years?
Why wouldn't we want to give him an opportunity after he stepped forward and said, yes, I'm the parent? Why don't we want to give him an opportunity to act like a parent at that point in time? Why do we have to rush to necessarily terminate his rights?
Counselor, don't we have to be concerned about the child that's growing up all the time when he's deciding if he's going to be a father or not be a father? You can't really put the child on a shelf like a book and get it down when you're ready to read it.
Actually, yes, we do. But I think that we also have to balance that against the fundamental right of parenthood. And so that's why I suggest, why couldn't we give him a chance? We could have put him on a chip sword at that time. If he behaved the same way, he would have gotten his rights terminated.
But pretty soon this child is not going to be adoptable, which is why I asked where the child was. And since 7 years of age, the child has been with people that's been represented to us, are willing to adopt her and give her a chance. And I understand that parental rights are very special and very sacred. But when you have a dysfunctional family, it's not uncommon to have the parent's right to be in direct conflict with the child's right to have a productive life as well, correct?
That's correct, but it's my understanding we have that two-step process in the termination of parental rights. And in that first step, it's a matter of establishing grounds. And it's my understanding that at that point in time, the parental rights do take precedent. Then, yes, the second step is what's in the best interest of the child.
I understand that, but, you know, he had the opportunity to come in and show good cause why, in fact, you know, he wasn't visiting the child, and if, in fact, the child had been kept from him or hid from him, I think then the law does say we're going to give the parent a chance. But when that hasn't happened, and it's really been through the parent's own volition that the child has been ignored, then I'm not sure that he hasn't had his chance.
Your Honor, I guess I would like to turn that around.
Okay.
Let's say, yes, it's 7 years old, and child's on seven, and James P. steps up and says, I want to be adjudicated. What if he turns out to be a terrific father for that child? Isn't that ultimately what the chapter is about?
It is, Counselor, and I would hope that that will happen to some children, but this is a child that's with someone. She's now going to be 10 in April. She's been there for 3 years. Ever since the child was 18 months old, he hasn't really had a relationship with the child. So, you know, I mean, every case turns to some degree on its facts. Aren't we stuck with those a little bit here?
Well, I guess, again, my argument is going to be is that if we continue, if he steps up and says, I'm the parent, well, then he still, I mean, again, if his behavior continues, he still doesn't have any contact with the child, they're still going to be able to terminate his rights. The child is living with the adoptive resource. I would guess that the child is probably not going to tell a whole lot of difference with what occurs just because her father might be on a CHIPS order, particularly if he behaves the same way. But again, we know then that we've protected his rights.
Thank you.
Don't you think the best interests of the child trump the father's rights?
I guess when you talk about the first phase, I think that the focus is supposed to be on the parental rights. I think that the case, I believe it's Santowski v. Kramer from the U.S. Supreme Court, comes down and talks about parental rights being a fundamental right. And I guess my concern is that...
Your answer is no.
Pardon?
Your answer is no. At least up to the first phase of termination, the best interests of the child do not trump the
the parents' rights.
Yes, Your Honor.
Under Quillian v. Wolcott, where you have to have an actual relationship that's ongoing, correct? Then the parental rights take second place.
But I'm sorry, I could barely hear you. I could barely hear you. I'm sorry.
Under Quillian v. Wolcott, if you do not have an actual relationship with the child, then the fact that you're the biological parent makes little difference and the child's rights are paramount.
Okay. As that's the case where the father was in Chicago, the biological father, and there was a out of found out the married father. Okay. First of all, that was not a TPR case. And yes, they did find, I believe, that the husband made the best parent, and that was the best place for that child to be, that he was the one that assumed parenthood. But again, we're not talking about termination of parental rights in that case. Yes, the biological father wanted to step in and assert some rights, but I think that that's distinct there on those facts, and it doesn't come into play in these statutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Tesser, and
thank you very much.
Ms. Hill-Roberts and Mr. Binger for your arguments today in yet another termination of parental rights case. We've had several in the last couple of years. That concludes our hearing on 04-0723, In Re Termination of Parental Rights to Shezron M. The court is in recess until 1:30 when we will hear our third case.